Wouldn't it be great if three idiots picked apart each episode of your favorite podcast?
We do that. Wouldn't it be great if we discussed the newest episode, ongoing theories, and predictions for what comes next?
We do that. Wouldn't it be great if they didn't ruin the podcast at all and kept everything spoiler-free?
We don't do that. You've been warned.
Welcome to We Do That, a Taz fan cast. I'm your co-host, Chris.
And I am the Banshee. Whoa, guys. What happened? It's me, your co-host, Jake.
And I'm your other co-host, Colin.
This week's episode, Dust, episode 3.
Okay, guys, before we dive in, I'll give you guys another quick synopsis. In this episode, Errol escapes the clutches of the Banshee's muscle men by willing an alarm bell into existence. Marcus, after being caged for years, it turns out doesn't really know that much about anything in the surrounding area. So the squad meets up, they have a meaningful moment with Dylan, and at long last, go to visit the Banshee. And I'll leave it there.
I just want to note that my head hurts. Because I hit it against the desk really hard there for that bit. I realize now that I could have just hit my hand and made the same sound effect. But I really wanted to
I appreciate your commitment.
Yeah.
You're really dedicated to our craft.
Yeah. Should we go for a take 40 now? And just one more? Is that we'll really get it?
The red spot on my head will just keep getting bigger.
That's for the director's cut when we add in the video from all these calls.
Oh, don't scare me like that.
I have been recording them all.
On that note, I cast Zone of Truth.
Okay. I have not been recording any of them. I predicted last time that the Banshee would be somebody we've heard of but have not met. Perhaps the person in the church. We still don't know who it is. I also said that Gandhi would die, Errol would die, and they'd all come back as a ghost squad. Hasn't happened yet.
I thought that the Banshee would make a deal that compromised Errol. Which didn't really happen, but the groundwork was set. Augustus sort of jumped into that role. I also thought that Marcus would have a bigger role to play and that he might even be the Banshee, which might be wrong, but might be right.
And I postulated that Isabella would be the Banshee, which pretty good chance that she's not. That the feeding would go much worse than it did, so wrong on two so far. And that there be some more infighting between Errol and Augustus based on sort of the Banshee and the Gandhi feeding whole shebang. Also no. So, not great, y'all.
Yeah, we didn't do not so great. High. Although, I do want to say, you know, before we jump too far ahead, or allowing me to jump too far ahead, rather, since the Banshee can possess things, maybe we were right this whole time. Maybe she was both Isabella and Marcus. So only Colin was wrong.
Well, now, I did say in an earlier zone of postulation that Sheriff Connors was not to be...
I don't have that episode recorded anywhere, Colin. There is just no evidence of that.
Well, shoot.
Although there is a note in my notes about this episode that says, God damn it, Colin was right.
Hell yeah.
So, I don't know what that's about.
So, I don't know how you burn a digital document, but we gotta figure that out for sure. Can't let that get out to the public. Alright guys, let's get into it from the top of this episode, shall we?
Yeah.
This was a really...
think I don't like Errol.
Oh, fair.
I am done with Errol. So... I could have spent a whole episode listening to him get shit talked.
Right.
Because that...
I think everybody else is also kind of done with Errol. I think this was a really great episode. This was a lot more fun than a lot of the other ones have been, but also had all that plot advancement that I think maybe is what I've been actually hankering for when I felt that stuff wasn't coming together.
And there was so much character development for everybody.
Yeah, because they had all those sort of classic moments with the three of them, or even even in sort of the out-of-character stuff where they're all just dunking on Errol the whole time. That was such a great scene. That made me so happy.
Yep.
Well, I agree. I thought it was hilarious. I thought it was very funny. And I thought it really showed that I don't know that Griffin could give up the reins of being a DM.
And I think his family has caught on and they're willing to just kind of throw that back in his face.
Yeah.
Are you as well liked as you think you are?
Yeah, right?
Hey man, if there isn't any gluten free stuff, should I go ahead and ring that bell?
that moment to me, you know, in addition to, you know, letting Errol get some, was the most classic Adventure Zone I think that I've felt since Balance. That the interaction between the three of them and all of these different roles, the four of them, just felt so great. It was hilarious. It fleshed out a world in a really interesting way, and I really appreciated it, especially because I don't like it.
And what I thought was also great is I think Travis really showed his strength as a DM is that he had a very clear perspective for just these two goons. Like, they knew what they were doing. They had a mission. He had all this ready. And he didn't let any of that get sidetracked by what was going on. He like, no, it's cool. We're just here to talk. Like, we'll just leave. It's fine. Like, we don't need to be here. I think it's great. Our great choices for him to be making for his characters and to sort of set up that the world exists outside of the three player characters.
Yes.
And even if they go off and do some nonsense and like try to push it in one direction, the world will keep going. And I think it shows that Travis has really thought through this more than maybe gave him credit for earlier, though I think overall he's been doing a great job as it is. And what he's built out is so clearly fleshed out in his mind that it makes it easy for him to roleplay those characters.
Yeah, and I think he tweeted earlier today about, or maybe it was yesterday evening, about really wanting to... You know, hoping that there's a the Adventure Zone. Because I would love, you know, like you're saying, like, there's so much more apparent now of his thinking, and I would love to hear more about that process. And how
even
we
him
came
just talking
to
about all the, when they were reviewing the clues at the top of the episode, that he has a list of all the things that they know and all the things that he knows.
Yeah.
Which is clear that there have maybe been either missed opportunities or bits of information that didn't come across, all this stuff that really shows such a fully fleshed out world. And I'm excited for that, the Adventure Zone to happen. I don't know if that'll, or maybe we'll get a quick wrap up after Dust when they start, before they go into the next arc.
Yeah.
So I definitely agree that this really did show how good Travis is at being a DM. And I thought he handled that with aplomb. I didn't think it was interesting to compare it to...
With a cashew?
What?
That was a really bad joke. Just move on.
That was... Oh, boy. I thought it would be interesting to compare it to what Griffin would have allowed if/as he were the DM, and if this is a potential issue with the sort of letting the characters create the world. Because I did think Travis handled it well. And I think if that were to happen in Balance, Griffin would be like, no, there's not an alarm bell there. Why would
right,
there
there's no bell over there.
Yeah.
Or you can't reach that, or your gun, you know, roll and your gun misses or whatever, or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the way he said, well, I figured there'd be an alarm bell in the community garden or whatever, because, you know, something Errol you know, something, Carry On Street. But yeah, it's just
I'm
like,
so great. I'm so great.
Yeah, it's not, it's, I get the feeling that Griffin, or from what I can tell, Griffin has a hard time role playing when he doesn't know, like, the ultimate end game for his character. Right? Like, everybody he's playing in Balance, he knows their story.
Yeah.
Because he has some, he has all the control over it.
Yeah. And I think that that comes across, we can sort of jump around, but since we're talking about the role playing, it comes across again when they go to see the Banshee at the end, because it seems like they're still making up the connections between these characters and these NPCs as they go through it, which I think is creating tensions that don't need to be there. And Griffin is role playing those tensions as like, this person is trying to kill me.
Yeah.
They, you know, they want me out of the way. And we don't fully understand why that might be. Like, we clearly that Griffin has a picture of how he left things, and Travis has a picture of sort of how they might exist. And they talk about a little bit of the episode about, you know, they were trying to use him as a political figure, and then they lost that power. So you could see that that maybe there is some animosity there, but we don't have any evidence for that. And so the fact that Griffin would go in so hard on the Banshee is out to kill me, it's a, you know, a threat at every moment, when yeah. Travis is playing it pretty straight. And I think there's reason, you know, in all these sort of tropes, there's reason to be cautious in any sort of situation like this. I don't think it's warranted to the extent that we're playing it. And I wonder, you know, the way in which Augustus, where Justin quickly stepped up and was like, hey, no, Augustus got this one. Like, I feel like if they had been the primary, they would have stepped up and taken the deal earlier.
Yeah.
And not gotten to that sort of threatening stage.
Yeah, I don't know how many times, I mean, I guess I could listen and count. But Travis, as the Banshee, had to offer that deal or increase the stakes to get Errol to accept, to the point that Errol never did. Which
right.
I think you're right. Travis is playing it straight, and Errol, Griffin has refused to play along.
Yeah, and that, you know, at the, I think, you know, Travis, I think a little bit tries to catch him out on it, where, you know, he threatens the Black Mariah, and he threatens the Cashew Company, and starts to threaten Carrion Street, and Augustus jumps right in and says it, and Griffin's like, oh yeah, that, I'm not going to let them. It's like, no, don't worry about it. We're good. We're done. I only need one person to say yes. Like,
yeah, fine. I'm not worried about you anymore.
Right, right. This ghost over here's got it.
Yeah.
Can't hold the thing, so curious, but we'll get to that. I guess he... No. We never actually heard what two he picked. Two of three. I have been corrected that I have been wrong for quite a while, and maybe all of us, that being touched, touching and be touching are not options three and four of a specter in Urban Shadows. There's only three. You could just be corporeal. Sorry okay. for everyone who...
That makes sense, but I feel like we picked that up from them, so...
Yeah, I mean, I blame the delivery for sure. Granted, I fixed it by reading the rules, so maybe that's a good way to start with these arcs.
Reading's a little dicey.
No, well, I mean, yes, for rule books of RPGs, there are going to be a lot of dice involved.
Oh, damn it. Kind of walked into that one, Jake.
Episode's over, we're done. Going on.
Yeah, I mean... He walked right into that one. I couldn't.
No, that was great. That was great. Like, I mean,
dicey.
Also,
I'm not reading any of the rule books.
If we're gonna start having a pun quota on the podcast, we're gonna be putting out some 5-minute eps real quick.
Just that's fair.
A couple easy weeks for us. While we're talking about what Travis knows and what Travis's plans are for the characters, can we go to Gandy and Augustus in the basement and the feeding?
Yeah.
Because I have a lot of questions about what Marcus did tell them and what Marcus was supposed to tell them. Because I felt like when the episode wrapped up last week, episode 2, Marcus had agreed to tell them who the outside party was who wanted to derail this thing, and agreed to share what he knew about the Banshee. And in this episode, Marcus tells them what he knows about the Banshee, which is nothing. And then Travis sort of says, like, and he shares about outside parties being a threat. He's like, well, I think you shared that part before the feeding happened, which is not how transactions should normally work.
Yeah, I thought the transaction just worked badly, because he was like, Gandhi asked the question, and then got her answer before she was ever fed upon, which just, she was like, oh, tell us who else would be, who did the killing, who's the killer. And he said, oh, think of outside parties. And, like, that was kind of it. And then she basically said, okay, well, I'm not going to do the feeding because that's garbage. Tell me who the banshee is. So I don't know. It did seem a little strange. I don't know that they got as much out of it. Well, I certainly hope they didn't get as much out of it as they were hoping.
Well, and I really liked that. I liked that, you know, Marcus saying, you know, or reflecting on the fact that, hey, he's been in a basement for 2 years. He doesn't know shit.
Yeah, bad dealing. I think that it was bad question asking on Gandhi's part again. So twice in this arc, Gandhi has asked poor questions. But it seems strange for Travis to create the setup to get them down there and see Marcus without Marcus being able to divulge more information. And I don't know if that was...
So, I read that situation as Isabella was the one they should have been asking all along, and they got distracted by the fact that, oh, hey, we've heard this guy's name before. He's here in a cage. Let's ask him some questions.
Yeah, that's fair.
Well, would you talk to the guy in the cage?
I won't say that I wouldn't make that same decision, but I... You know, from an outside perspective on this narrative, that seems like an obvious misdirect.
Well, I wonder if Travis was expecting them to maybe go through the feeding, but then maybe hammer home on Isabella, like, to pump her for more information, than just leaving.
She has had a big dinner.
Well, that's fair. Time. You know,
fair. Yeah, he gets
that is polite, I guess.
Yeah, they had to
allow
leave
some nap time. Come back later in the morning.
No, I think Griffin jumped right ahead. Right, okay, it's time to meet up, rather than
letting that scene happen.
Yeah.
If there was a scene to be had,
exactly. Well, like I don't know that there was, but he was really gung ho about everybody meeting up. So,
which I think is sensible. I mean, we're in episode 3. If we're sort of at the halfway point. You know, in the play version of this, if we're heading into intermission between Act 1 and Act 2, we would have a big sort of sharing session, and then we'd head up to a cliffhanging point to get us in action into the second act.
Yeah.
And if he was trying to anticipate that and try to get stuff done this episode so that it moves along properly, I understand the thought process somewhat. The brevity of the Marcus scene and Marcus's role in this episode did not seem to really mesh well with how large of a role he played in episode 2. And I'm curious, and I, you know, the more we talk about this, the more I really want to just hear Travis tell the story with no player characters in it to see what was happening. Because I wonder, you know, is it a Travis thing, or is it Gandhi and Augustus not asking the right questions?
Yeah.
Or is it Gandhi and Augustus going along with Errol driving the story for, like, driving the action forward? Which I thought was interesting, because they all got together to then retrace their steps. Like, they went back to the sheriff's office. And that was kind of frustrating for me, is I understand why they did it, but go collect more new information.
I think that was a fair time to arrive, though, and knowing... With the revelation about the wedding, that puts all of Dylan's interactions into sort of a new light.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, Dylan's not going anywhere. And, like, now...
No, but if he would give up more info about it, or if he had more, you know, if you can use the wedding info to crack another layer of him and get some more depth on the deal and all these things that are happening, maybe that would show the other parties, like, oh, well, you know, the wedding had to happen really fast because... There's a water company who wants to buy the mine, like, you know, something there could be a plot point in there.
But I even in the moment, yeah. I didn't think that what you were going to get from Dylan would have helped you out with the Banshee, where they were going regardless. And now that they've gone to see the Banshee, and they told him, watch out for Sheriff Connors, they now are going to have to go back to the sheriff's office and spend more. I mean, it kind of reminds me of, you know, one of those, like, point-and-click games, like A Mystery of Monkey Island or whatever it was. And, you know, you're just trying to go to one place in the right order to signal these events. And it just didn't make any sense to go talk to Dylan then. Dylan is a known resource. He may not have told you everything, but he's not going anywhere.
I suppose that when you have the two loose ends of Dylan and the Banshee, you could close one out and presumably be done and then go to Dylan. But again, if they had gone to Dylan and then the Banshee had said, you know, you have to go investigate the church, well then, do they go to Dylan or do they go to the church? I mean, it could have opened another whole nother avenue.
I think you keep going to new areas until you don't have new areas to go to. They've been to the sheriff's office. I don't think you revisit it until you have something concrete to do there. To question Dylan again, you guys already doubt he did it. So maybe it provides you with motive for Liam, which is fine and fair, but they didn't go and act on that information anyway. They said, okay, well, let's go to the bank. So it's not like that changed their plans anyway. I just didn't think it made a lot of sense.
Yeah, I see it. I see the point you're making. I don't know that the order of operations would have changed. Well, who knows? I don't know what the story would have turned out to be going the other way. But I see what you mean.
If they'd gone to the Banshee first, they wouldn't have necessarily told the sheriff everything that they told.
Yes, but that wouldn't have been as exciting storytelling.
I think it's a very curious and possibly genius mechanic that when having a moment of intimacy with a wizard makes it harder for you to escape situations. Because when they read the rules, I did not understand it at first. But processing it more, like if you're forming a bond with someone, you're less likely to leave. I think that is a really neat way to handle building connections and have them have an impact in the world rather than just being additional assists. Because it shows, you know, to the nature of what Travis was saying about a dirt grittier arc, like, the connections they make can be valuable, but they can also be detrimental. They can have sort of a negative consequence.
Well, then, you know, I think that's an interesting way to read it that I hadn't quite gotten to myself, because that whole segment frustrated me because based on Augustus's character and the way he responded, I don't feel like his watching over Gandhi was as protective as it was suddenly made out to be. But I think the wording of that trade-off should be made more clear then. You know, a -1 to escape if the person with whom you've shared intimacy is with you. Because the way I just read it was that he now has a -1, he has a penalty to whatever he does, or to any escape situation. And so maybe, you know, again, haven't read the rules, just sort of flying by the information that were presented. And it's a question that I had, because it was so starkly different to just the raw benefit that Augustus got. It seemed weird that sharing that intimacy moment also penalized him.
Well, but it's a boon to Gandhi. When Gandhi's in trouble, Augustus can go there. And it's a penalty to Augustus.
Well,
can't escape.
Yeah, no, and so I guess, you know, from a gameplay perspective, no one should ever share intimacy moments with a wizard.
Well, naturally.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's what the game is saying.
Friggin' wizards.
Can't trust them, man. Can't trust them.
I did think that was a very interesting gameplay mechanic, and I think it's very sort of unique, like you were saying, Chris, that this positive this thing that would generally be considered positive will in fact be a detriment to one of the players. I thought that was very creative, and I love that idea. I also think, to your point, Jake, I don't think there's any way Augustus was watching over Gandhi. I think he would have been more just fascinated to see what happened.
Well, right, and you know how easily he fed her up. Like,
yeah, I wish
we
I
need,
could do
we,
it.
We need to reconcile the fact with, as described, Augustus is not a good dude.
Well,
you know,
I think Gandhi recognized that because she said, even though you're probably just there, you know, for kicks. Yep, accurate.
You know. It seemed like that whole situation seemed kind of weird to me. You know, the introduction of this mechanic. You know, because we've already written off the mechanic that at the start of every sort of session, there's trusting and distrusting.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it adds to the story very much to throw this in there on such an inconsequential moment, you know?
But I would argue, and I think maybe Travis knew this, that they might not be heading for a lot of other moments of intimacy in this arc. I think you can read a lot into small gestures, and that I don't think it was, you know, totally uncalled for Travis to call out that moment. Because again, this is something that Travis called out, not the two of them did at all. That they were just sort of going about this conversation. They were just bantering, and Travis said, hey, that's a moment of intimacy. So I think that, you know, Travis is putting the weight on it, and I think in that sense, you can maybe trust that in the way he's either envisioned the world, that these little moments matter. Again, if he's going for sort of a darker, maybe bleaker outlook on things, especially in this setup where, like, the whole town is riding on this one deal, and that's what's going to fix it, otherwise it's going to dissolve into chaos, this one moment of sharing some food with somebody after a rough night can be a pretty important thing. And so maybe it's just a sliding scale for this arc and what expectations are. And maybe that's a part of the game, or maybe that's a part of just the story.
Okay, I can buy that.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's one of those moments where Augustus is not a good dude, but maybe he's not as bad as he thinks he is. You know, sort of where your actions betray what you might want to think of yourself. For better or worse. I don't know. I did think it was a bit of a silly moment with the ghost cashews. And Augustus and Gandhi Dancer were clearly sort of having a joke that Travis took and you know, built into something a little more. Which I don't know was 100% appropriate because, as Augustus says, ghost cashews have no nutritional value and don't help you
right
whatsoever.
He just wanted to see what happens.
Yeah, but it was I don't know. I didn't hate it.
It's odd being the pessimistic one this episode.
Feels good, doesn't it?
Usually Colin has that role locked down.
Love it.
Well, maybe we're all evolving as people. That happens sometimes.
Oh, no. Do I have a corruption point now?
I think so. I think I never fully understood how those worked. Because I could have sworn, like, doing that Bloodhound thing would earn Griffin a corruption point.
Yeah, didn't it in the first episode?
I'm almost certain it did, but not enough to go double check.
Yeah, I think they're drawing some strange line between using the Bloodhound spell or ability and starting a hunt, and it's a line that I am not sure exists in the rulebook.
I mean, was it because he was
again,
on
though,
in reading. His territory? Was that something with it? I don't know.
I don't know. Griffin's doing whatever he wants. Just let it happen and move on.
Yeah, it's clear he's not ready to give up the reins.
One thing I did like about the... Another thing I liked about the sharing episode is Justin kind of calls out that the gloves are a bit of a red herring in the way that Travis has manufactured their description.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they have silver dust on them, but also they've been thoroughly cleaned. Mm-hmm. You know, Justin kind of calls out, like, I'm not sure how those two things happen, but let's not break the fiction.
Or it's planted evidence.
Yeah,
you know?
Or like, they've been cleaned and then they reintroduce silver dust, so
exactly.
It appears that they've just been used for work and not murder.
Murder. Yeah, I mean, when I heard the descriptions, I was thinking the same thing that I think Justin was, in that I was thinking, that's a red herring, don't go down that road, it's not Liam. I wonder if it's maybe of a higher level that it is Liam and he's just trying to cover his tracks better. But I am pretty confident that Liam's not going to be the person we're looking for.
Yeah, it still feels a little too obvious.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there are too many, boxes that haven't been punched, too many things they haven't visited, haven't done yet, for it to be Liam.
Well, and I'm still fascinated because they talked in the setup episode about how other towns exist outside of Dry River. And that has not come up at all. You know, Travis talks about it being very important that this arc takes place in the Crescent Territory. You just start in Dry River. But I am wondering if that's ever going to play out.
You know, and I just don't think it can in an 8-hour span. You know, given that
we have to
traveling by stagecoach or, you know, single horse at the fastest.
Right. We'd have to allow some liberties for travel time, for sure.
You know, it just doesn't make sense to expand the narrative in that way.
I don't know. It doesn't, to me.
It'd
be great if, like, hours 5 through 7 were them just sitting on a stagecoach.
Just deciding what to order for, like, on a rail car?
Yeah, just talking to each other.
Roll for Dramamine.
Yeah. How is your nausea on this particular part of the delivery?
Hey, man, last time they were all on a train, it made for a very amusing mini-arc. Or arc. Or whatever.
Yeah, but there was plot on the train. Like, not just going between plots.
Well, how you don't know that this isn't going to end in a murder mystery on a train.
Is Gandhi a juicy wizard? Oh, God. Felt real bad to say. I don't want to say that again.
Oh, boy.
So, I'm going to just move on.
Gandhi?
What
was the juicy wizard's name? Graham?
Yeah, Graham.
Does that make Errol Jess the Beheader?
No, because I like Jess the Beheader.
And who would Augustus be?
Angus.
That's the only person left. But, yeah.
Jenkins.
His shiny bow tie. His weird droopy.
All right, onwards, Jake. Give us something to talk about, please.
So,
for the love of God.
I just want to revisit balance.
Let's talk about the interactions at the sheriff's office. We know in hindsight that maybe we shouldn't trust the sheriff, which none of us ever predicted.
Come on! You never trust the quest giver.
But I think, you know, the highlight of this episode was sort of the acting and development that happened between Dylan and Errol and Augustus. As we learn that, you know, Dylan loved Jeremiah, and you could just feel the heartbreak in Travis's portrayal of this moment. It was just so so powerful. What did you guys think about all of that?
This is a moment that I don't... because what we generally do is critique things, I have very little to say, because I think it played out... I think they played it all out very well. And I don't have anything funny to say about it, because I think they did such a great job. I don't want to cheapen any of
their performances. Yeah, right? Like...
You know, Justin's speech was in one of those inspiring things that Justin could come up with sometimes, and it's just really great. I think the way the Travis's performance, and I think it's another example of the depth and clarity with which he's built these NPCs is stunning. They're, you know, obviously fully fledged in his mind, and the more we get to see about them, the more exciting it is to know about these characters he's created and the amount of thought and care he's put into this arc. I mean, yeah, Errol was there too.
So
that's fine. I feel like, Jake, you've given me permission to like hate on Errol more, because I'll take a little bit of that too.
He was a catalyst for the moment. But
so, my turn. I really like the moment.
Zone of posture.
<What? laughs> I thought what Justin said, I thought it was a great sort of speech type thing that's sort of off the cuff, extemporaneous, and I thought it was very well done, and I did like the backstory, the heart and emotion Travis put in to Dylan. What bothered me more was a little bit mechanics wise. In that, as soon as Errol said wedding, it's like Dylan could not wait to tell them. Like, it did, like, it was before Errol even finished the sentence, she told us about the wedding. Dylan was asking a follow-up question. And it seemed like there was almost, like, a magic word, and suddenly he's willing to share any and everything. And that doesn't... It didn't mesh with my expectations for what somebody in that environment would necessarily be willing to do. I mean, perhaps it kind of marks, oh, if Anne trusted you, then surely I can trust you too, or something like that. But that, it was just like a faucet turned on to these people that he has.
You know, and see, like, I don't know if I agree with you, because...
Shocking.
There we go. From Dylan's perspective, he's got what? 6 hours before he's hanged?
Yeah. But that was never persuasive to him before. That has not changed that much since the first time they talked to him.
No, but knowing that he has someone that he can at least share his emotion with before he theoretically is put to death, that's a really powerful weight to be able to share with someone.
And I think you could chalk it up to almost two things. One, that he's probably coming out of shock, so is maybe more willing and more coherent now than he was when they first encountered him 2 hours ago. And the second being that, given the emotional state that he was in prior to that and all the background to it, I could see the wedding being a trigger word. Just somebody mentioning it, forcing him to think about it, really opening some floodgates. Whether that would lead to sort of all of the divulging of information that we got, I could speculate on a little bit. But I don't think it was that far out of the realm of possibility.
Like, I think... I don't know that it was super far out of the realm of possibility necessarily, because, like you said, it's an emotionally charged moment, and I understand they needed it for the purposes of the gameplay. It just seems as though... which I'm not faulting them for, necessarily. You know, the story's got to move forward, and you did the due diligence in finding out this nugget of information that will quote-unquote... I mean, I'm quoting myself, so... That will... That will, like, unlock Dylan, right? Like, he's not going to tell you anything until you find out about the wedding, and they've done their due diligence in that regard. So now you've got to give them, you know, that extra information. It just felt... the way he was playing it before, I was like, no, go away. I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to talk to you. To just, oh, you know, here is everything. Here's the guy who I think did it. Here's why. Here, I mean... It went from 0 to 60, not just in terms of the emotions, but in terms of like the exposition for me. A little too much. A little too convenient.
Yeah. Okay. I don't think so, but sure.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from. I can, you know, understand why people would disagree with that. What really got me that really, and you know, it was probably the first impression, whatever, was when Errol first said and told us about the wedding, and Errol never finished that first sentence. He's in the middle of the sentence where he goes, "What did she tell you?" And it was just like, it really felt like flipping a switch. Like, there wasn't a moment of contemplation at that moment of like, oh, shit, these people know. What does that mean for me? You know, I think if even there was a moment of silence between what Errol said and Dylan's reaction, my reaction would have been different. But it was so instantaneous that it was like they were...
So you think just... Travis was a little too eager to get all that stuff out and sort of push the plot forward a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, like I said, I think it was a wonderful moment, and I even don't mind the way Errol interacts with it, because I think in that situation you need somebody who kind of takes the lead, and kind of pushes it forward, and you know, somehow cut through the awkward silences and the awkward moments, and he's like, oh yeah. So I'm even fine with Errol's, the way Griffin plays it as Errol. It was just that first moment where it's like flipping a switch or opening a dam. It's everything all at once. And that's just, I don't know. It doesn't seem like how people act to me. Not that I really know people that well. but maybe it's how werewolves act. Is he a werewolf?
Dylan?
I think he's a wolf.
Yes.
Yeah.
So. No. Yes. Yes, definitely.
Yes. Woof! Lost it for a little while there. I'm back now.
Yeah, see? Same. It's hard to keep all of them straight. So anyway, that was my one critique of that moment. I did think it was a really wonderful moment, besides, and I thought it was impressive that we managed to get a moment of that meaning within like 3 episodes, because I don't think we ever got anything like that in Amnesty, even when they tried.
Yeah,
right. Even when they tried to get something like that, it just wasn't there.
Well, I think it helps when your characters spend more than one episode together.
Yes, yes. Well, I wasn't trying to turn it back to critiquing Griffin. But I'm happy.
But I think they're fair points. I think it, you know, as a whole, I think it shows the value of, if you're going to go down this group-generated narrative, the group needs to be together. That the dynamic the four of them have is really critical to the success of the stories they're trying to tell and the relationships they're building. The need for everyone to be together is really a driving force to really create strong narrative moments. Otherwise, it's just one person playing in someone else's story, and that is not as exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I think it holds true even in this episode when you compare, you know, Errol being off by himself and raising alarm bells from nowhere, to all three of them being together and the kind of stuff they create.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, honestly, I think honestly, it's just I think every scene is better when Justin's in it.
Well, and you know, I liked that they had the option to split up again, right? And they chose not to. They made the decision together, you know, Clint's prodding or not, that splitting up isn't the best choice right now. And I think by creating more of those moments where they can interact,
yeah,
it helps get to everything you're talking about.
And they don't seem to be tracking the beat as rigorously as I feared they might. About, like, what time it is and how much time do you have left. And
yeah, Travis seems to have been a little lax in his sort of counting. But I think it's... I think they are keeping to it pretty well, though, if we go back and sort of count the beats. If it's... you know, the tail end of Carrion Street is still really from the last episode, and then it's the tail end of the Gandhi Augustus Marcus interaction. So then we have sort of at the Black Mariah in the street, then we have at the jail, and then we have going to see the Banshee, and that's three moments. Three moments is sort of what Travis has been aiming for to get through those couple hours. The question will be if we roll over into next episode and it's still 3 o'clock in the morning. We've missed some parts.
Yeah, well, and I don't think he's been doing a bad job of it, and I'm glad he hasn't been like narrating every. Okay, well, that's one beat. That's two. Like the way they're doing it feels much more natural.
Yeah, and I think as long as Travis lines up the timeline so that they do run out of time by episode 5, I think we'll be in a good place.
Yeah, and I think they will.
So let's head on to that last moment that you mentioned, Chris, where they finally meet the Banshee. What do y'all think?
Sort of.
Oh, they met her.
Hers a strong choice. Yeah, so the Banshee is clearly a specter who's become corrupted, which I think makes sense. That's the only way you can possess bodies in this game. How the other two goons get out is a question that I have, but whatever.
Well, probably the door.
See, I kind of even imagined that they were sort of projections. That, you know, because Errol never touched them.
Well, and but so, they held out the business card.
Yeah, I don't think they were specters. I think Errol went into the room and they walked out the door. They did. They got him into the room, and then they left. Because, I mean, it was a separate
room. That's much less fantastical than I was imagining.
Okay,
but you wanted them to just dissolve back into piles of dust from which they were created?
Yes, very much so.
They might be golems. I think
you're probably right.
Yeah, I mean, it would be cool if they were golems, and then this, you know, Banshee's a ghost, and there's a whole thing going.
Not so okay with Colin being right twice in one episode.
Well, you don't have to say it. You can just let it happen.
Well, it's been said now. It's on the record. No, Jake, don't delete that audio file.
I think I said, you know, most of my points sort of at the beginning when we were talking about Errol as a whole. But I liked the Banshee coming in. I think it felt like sort of the quintessential scene where the bad guy just shows up and has value. I think the question becomes whether the Banshee becomes the ultimate big bad and it somehow turns back around again and this is a double cross, or if they're just a very large and important but still side character to the plot that Travis is creating. Or if it comes back around and they actually join forces later for some sort of epic spectral battle that happens at the end. I imagine not, but be cool.
You know, and so that's what I wonder, is because if the Banshee is capable of possessing people, who has she possessed that we've met in the story already, and why?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it calls a lot of things into question about previous interactions and things we were trusting.
I mean, I don't think anybody.
Would you know that, though?
Not necessarily. except for the fact that the person she inhabited was either dead or died as a result of.
So, because I put out there that it's possible the Banshee was inhabiting Marcus.
Yeah, like, we don't... Hashtag rules. We don't know.
Well, I mean...
You know, so yes. I'm extrapolating. In this one instance... So, and so, like, I don't know. You know, that is certainly one way. Or, I think the much more insidious, you know, scary way would be that it doesn't matter. And that, you know, the Banshee can possess whomever and sort of leave blank spots in their memories while she's doing whatever she wants.
There's probably a way to figure out what's allowed. But it requires us reading the rule book.
We'll get to that. We can talk about the rules anytime. But I think we've pretty solidly committed to not knowing the rules until the McElroys tell us the rules, and then being confused by the rules they told us. And if we give up on that, how can people trust us anymore?
That is so true. That's a great point, Chris. Well said.
Thank you. I think it was a fun scene. I think it's cool that Travis clearly has something pretty big in mind and a turnabout coming.
The thing that gets me is, like you said, Chris, this is sort of not. I mean, it is, and it's sort of a trope, where you go see the big bad, at some point in, you know, some point relatively early in the story, and they don't do anything to harm you. Like, they're actually helpful in some regard. And then
it's a question of whether they turn around later and
be the big bad.
It all goes wrong. Yeah.
Right. Which, I have to imagine, Griffin is aware of that trope. And as difficult as it was to get him in the same... Like, as much as he did not play along with anything regarding the Banshee this episode, it drove me crazy. It's just... Just go. They're not going to kill you. I mean, maybe they will, and that's fine. It's you become a ghost.
Yeah, then that's an exciting thing for the audience to experience of what happens when a player character dies, and, you know, it's a turnabout.
Yeah, well, plus, they know you're with two, you know, compatriots or whatever. They know that they would come looking for you as well. Like,
yeah,
just go.
And presumably when, you know, if an agent of the agency goes down, there's probably a larger force to come to bear to deal with those sorts of things.
Yeah. Yeah. It really frustrated me. And then he wouldn't take the deal. It's like, just take the deal and don't keep up your end of the bargain.
Right. Yeah. But that's probably a character choice where Errol is unwilling to perform a double cross. That, you know, his word is his bond.
What sort of fucking politician was he going to be?
I mean, a bad one. He's not. I think that's the point. He has zero, like, charisma and no mind. And I think he was going to be a bad one.
Saying, you go, you take the deal, and then you don't keep your word on any of it. Because why would you keep your word to the Banshee anyway, unless you're afraid of her killing you?
Well, and I think he is afraid of her killing him. And again, we don't know that she's female. It's female. They're female. Fuck. Now I'm caught up in pronouns. But again, it's that tension, which is very important, has not been fleshed out. We do not know why there is tension between the Banshee and Errol, to the extent that it would make sense for the story. I mean, they talked about that they tried to turn him, and I guess we have that, but that doesn't really feel like enough to have this deep-seated fear that Errol has about what's coming for him.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, I think a lot of that is just the difference between how they play their roles. Because I don't think there was that sort of... I mean, I didn't get any of that tension from Travis, and maybe that's because he was the one in, you know, power in the moment. But man, that whole scene, not just that scene, but the scenes with the goons, That just frustrated the hell out of me. Just come on, Errol. Come on, Griffin, say yes.
Right, buy in for a little bit.
Yeah, do those rules of improv, not for the sake of Errol, but for the sake of what's quote unquote narratively interesting. Because, I mean, isn't that what he told people on Amnesty and all that? I think this is what will be narratively interesting. So do that.
Yeah.
Just do it.
Right, so there's very little through. Narrative interest in saying, nah, I'm not going to go to this new place with these new characters and meet this new person who has new bits for my story.
Yeah, just, nah, I don't want to do that. Here, magic bell. It wakes up the entire block. I'm very bitter.
No, I agree. And I think it's something that needs some experimenting with and sort of playing with. So I guess I want to start thinking about what might happen next week.
Well, tomorrow. Thursday.
Thursday.
This week.
This week. What if our listeners weren't listening to this in any particular order, Chris? That didn't make any sense.
I mean, it's still not
good for them.
It's still going to happen this week. Like,
why are they doing that to themselves? It's a sequential.
We exist in time with when the episodes appear.
But time is a flat circle.
Don't stop. Thinking about tomorrow. Don't stop. Soon you'll be here.
Huh.
Till you'll be here.
Better than before. Hey, Colin, you know what I need?
What do you need?
I think he wants you to take us to the zone,
of postulation.
Okay, so I guess... Is it only when we say zone of postulation that you're going
to
interrupt
us?
Yes,
the only way it works is he interrupts us. We have to lead into it. So you have to be, you just have to commit to him ruining a thing you're going to say.
Well, no. And that I get. But is it the word zone of postulation that triggers him? Because I was trying to get there by saying, hey, let's talk about what's going to happen next week.
No, you got to say the words. You got to say the words.
So I did. That goes in my rules book because I didn't know that.
Well, you don't know the rules until we say them.
Right.
Yes, and
welcome
we
to this
said
podcast.
Them.
That's the trope. Listen, you say wedding, you get a bunch of facts. You say zone of postulation, Colin says the bit.
Zone of postulation.
Only once per week.
So what are we going to do on Thursday?
Okay, once per episode.
There it is.
Okay, so I think... that the sheriff is going to realize his gig is up and our characters are going to rush back to the jail and catch him in the act of trying to kill Dylan, probably making it look like a suicide. They will save Dylan, but the sheriff will escape.
I'm going to plant my flag on two things this week. One, there's not going to be an episode this Thursday. Two, I think they don't interact with Connors. I think they just go ahead and try to pull a good old-fashioned jailbreak, going right for the Banshee. I think they, like, back the Black Mariah up into Dylan's cell, pull him out, and ride off to try to figure things out.
I think those are both insane. I think they're going to go to the address that's printed on the card that the Banshee gave them, use the key to enter that house or whatever it is, whatever key they got, and go find some shit out. I think the Banshee...
Oh, that sounds way less exciting.
I think the Banshee will still
be... Yeah, that was real bad.
...connected. Do we know when Augustus died? Like...
Yes.
How many...
8 years ago.
8 years ago. Okay. So, could the Banshee be his daughter? Is there any way?
Maybe.
Because that's a feeling I'm getting, because they've given her all these names, so she has to appear. You know,
it's possible. Sure.
Chekhov's right. Anna. So, yeah, that's what I think will happen. I don't even think Connage will be in next week's episode. Thanks, everybody, for listening to We Do That. Next episode, we will be talking about the next episode of Dust. And you should tune in and see what we got right, what we got wrong, and what we just missed entirely.
In the meantime, you can find us on Twitter at WeDoThat_pod and tweet at us using the AtazFanCast hashtag or email us at WeDoThatPod@gmail.com. Send us your reactions, thoughts, and theories.
So we can shamelessly steal them.
Special thanks to The Early for our intro and outro music.
New episodes of We Do That come out every Monday after The Adventure Zone, except when The Adventure Zone comes out on Mondays, in which case it'll come out on Wednesday or Thursday of that week. And except for this coming week, when we're traveling over this weekend and our episode will come out on Tuesday. So next episode's on Tuesday. This episode's going to be on Wednesday. Episodes are normally on Monday, as long as their episode comes out on Thursday. Look, watch the Twitter for a flowchart.
It's just like the rules. You don't know them until you have to say them. If you like listening to us, or even if you don't, please, go onto iTunes or whatever your preferred podcast medium, rate, subscribe, review, share it with the other Taz fans in your life, and let people know we're out here.
And let us know what you think. We would love to get some fan theories on here. Surely we can't be the other only ones getting it wrong every week.
Yeah.
So at us and let us know. Are you getting it right? Do you have it pegged? Who's the killer? Who's the banshee?
Yeah, and specifically send them to me so I can appear smart to Jake.
Until next week. Bye, everybody.